Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Premier League podcast. So we're going to go through the weekend's fixtures in order. We're going to start with Friday night, Leicester Norwich, and a good win for a team bottom of the league who, quite frankly, looked to me too good to be bottom of the league. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I think they've started the revival a bit late, but showing some good signs against an informed Leicester. So they're not going to. I think it's just for pride now. It's not for the league. I reckon they're definitely relegated. It's not for the league, but it's just to bring the fans something.
So you think it's too late in the day for them to salvage themselves?
Yeah, I think it is. Now, they've got Daniel Farke and Timo Pukki and a lot of other people, but they don't have the firepower like some other teams in the Premier League.
But it was a bit ironic because at the start of the season they were scoring, so
especially in August they were definitely in top form. They drew. Did they beat us? I think they drew or beat Chelsea at home.
Beat Man City.
Yeah, so they looked good, but unfortunately didn't have the firepower to get through the rest of the season.
I read a comment yesterday that they're one of the best teams ever to be bottom of the league, which I think is it a compliment or is it a little bit annoying because they're not going to stay up by the looks of it?
I think it can, there's both sides to look at it. I think it can be good for the fans and that, but it shows how tough the Premier League is, and for upcoming teams like Leeds, Brom and Fulham, they'll take notes from Norwich and see what they can do.
Yeah, see how to do it. Do you think they were value for the win?
Yeah, I feel that it was quite surprising. I mean, they were the underdogs by far. I was expecting Leicester to maybe win by 2-3 goals, but
well, Leicester had one disallowed, didn't they, an offside goal, so that would put them 1-0 up. VAR ruled that it was offside, and I think it was. Or was it handball?
I think it was handball.
Handball, wasn't it? And it was handball, I think. I remember saw the replay. So the ground was rocking by the end of it.
Yeah. It was like, I think it marked the day when the, it was like 15 years ago when that Norwich fan was saying, like, no, the Norwich owner was
Delia Smith.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. They referenced that a lot on Sky and it was on Twitter a lot this weekend as well, that. So we moved into Saturday. The lunchtime game wasn't very exciting. I did sit through it. Brighton Palace. Not much to write home about. 3 points for Palace. Any thoughts on Brighton?
Well, when Graham Potter first came, I think he did well. He started to get points against the big teams, and he started to put his own style on the Brighton side. But now I think, I don't know, they're not creative enough, and they don't have that one good player. Do you like every team in the Premier League has got that one standout player? For me, Brighton doesn't have that. You feel like Palace, I think Zaha's a standout player and he's going to create chances. Who's in that Brighton side that's going to create chances?
Yeah. He missed one late on Zaha, I think, that he should have buried. And they had Glenn Murray on the bench, which is, he's a bit of a journeyman now and he hasn't got a lot of pace. He's towards the end of his career, but he can put the ball in the net, so it's surprising that
he's got a good record against Crystal Palace as well, and I don't get why he's not up there. So for me, it's like Haller in West Ham. He's big, he's up front, so he'll win the aerial battles for people to come round and flick on. And I reckon he'll be that creative spark for that team.
Could be a similar player, maybe.
Yeah, I feel like, well, Brighton, I know how Dan said they don't really have that spark of a player, but I kind of disagree. They've got that Trossard, and I've seen him play a few times. He's got something about him that is quite unique. He's not one of the best players you'll ever see, but in that Brighton side, you can like kind of compare. And he seems quite good, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a solid Premier League player, maybe. Okay, so then we moved into the 3 o'clock was on Saturday. I think the biggest kind of surprise or point taken, so Chelsea were 1-0 up at Bournemouth. It went to 2-1 Bournemouth and then 2-2 in the end. Decent point for Bournemouth, or Chelsea just doing what they keep doing, which is throwing points away?
I think it's a decent point for Bournemouth, you know. They're struggling in the Premier League, and I think that might kickstart this little end of the season for them, just to see if they can get rid of the drop, and just they're not a big club, but they've been cemented into the Premier League for a good couple of years now. So I think Eddie Howe's a good manager, so I think they'll stay up.
I think you're right. I think they're an established Premier League side now, and they're a model. You mentioned some of the teams who might be coming up from the Championship that they can be looked at. The way the clubs run, the fans, the supporters, the atmosphere on a match day. I'd like to go to an away game at Bournemouth. I think it would be a good game. And I think that they've got that behind them, and it's a shame, really, that they've had this slump mid-season.
Yeah, I feel like Eddie Howe's still the man for them. I feel like they sack him. I can't really think of a manager who they'd bring in. Maybe Brighton's former manager. But you think of Bournemouth and you kind of think of Eddie Howe because he used to play for him. Mm-hmm. He obviously had his spell at Burnley and then went back to Bournemouth. And yeah, he's if Eddie Howe gets sacked, I can see him going to a bigger club than Bournemouth.
I think so. I thought for a while though, he was maybe on Arsenal's radar, wasn't he? That he might go there. And I think it would be a shame if they did sack him, and I think quite a silly thing to do as well, because like you say, he is that club through and through, and we haven't got enough of that in the league.
Yeah, and I think I feel like the owners have expressed their feelings about him, saying that they've been very open with it, saying that Eddie Howe is the man for the job. Yeah. And
okay, are you going to add more to that one?
No, I just think in a couple of years time, if he does keep his form up, he could possibly be the England manager. So
wow, big shout.
I think he could be. I think he's got all the capacities to do it. So
there's a prediction, first prediction on the podcast we've made. Southampton then, Southampton West Ham. I think, were it not for the result we're going to discuss later, that could have been the shock of the weekend, really, because West Ham have been in a really poor run of form. I know they played well at Anfield on Monday, but they've not been picking up points. 3-1 winners.
They definitely deserved it, and I think the whole club was under a lot of immense pressure. So I think they all played well, especially the front three. I think they played exceptionally well. And I think they've got a good formula now. Yeah. They just need to keep going. David Moyes has started to control the side. Now he just needs to get some results. I reckon they were unlucky on Monday against Liverpool, but today and at the weekend they just found the right rhythm.
Yeah. Moyes has maybe put his stamp on it, so to speak. You mentioned the protest before we started recording, Xander, and do you think that would have had an impact on the players, on the atmosphere at the ground?
Yeah, I feel like with the protests going on, I feel like the players will want to express the feelings, maybe. Some maybe might agree with the fans, but the ones who don't agree and think the owners are the right people, they'll want to kind of play it better than they have been and trying to show, well, the owners, they own the club, they're doing well, and you're just not seeing it, so yeah.
Do you think that's the right way for the players to respond with the performance they put in, 3 points?
Yeah, I feel like it's different because the fans, they'll protest more if you lost.
Yeah.
There'll be more to be angry about, and obviously football plays a lot with passion, and when something's not going right at a football club, then like the heat of the moment can get better of you.
Yeah, I've read a couple of things on Twitter after that some of the fans who protested will be a little bit gutted that they did win, which seems a backwards way around of looking at things when it's your football club and it's your passion. So let's get to the big one then. Let's get to the one that you two have been dying to talk about. So the tea time kickoff. There it was, Liverpool on a quest to win the 19th game in a row. Didn't win. First loss of the season. You've got massive, great big grins on your face. Dan, you can start.
I think Liverpool were very sloppy how they played, and I think I think in their minds they already won the game. You looked at their body language and you looked at how they were playing around. They made no chances, and they got one shot on target throughout the whole game. Mm-hmm. And that's not like the Liverpool we've seen over the past year.
Not at all.
Yeah, I feel like ever since that loss at Atletico Madrid, they've kind of been on a decline in form. Against West Ham, you were lucky to get back into it. Mm-hmm. You were behind, and now it's happened again. And surprisingly, you didn't get back into it. And, well, like, Sarr, he was good and got 2 goals. Yeah.
Do you want to credit Watford at all, then, their performance, the way they played?
Yeah, because they just lost 3-0 against United, and they're down in the dumps, and it came out of nowhere, and that could give them that confidence to stay up. So
I thought Nigel Pearson had nothing left in him, but he came out miraculously and managed to get 3 points against the top dogs. So
I'll tell you what annoyed me about it. We talked about him last week on the podcast, didn't we? And we said he'd sort of had his honeymoon period, and they were on a bit of a slide. So I agree. I thought Liverpool were extremely flat, and it was an extremely disappointing performance. I will say that as soon as I saw the team sheet, and I don't want to pin it all on one player, but when I saw that Lovren was playing, number one, I thought, what on earth is going on there?
Yeah, but Matic was on the bench, though, as
he
well.
He was, and that's a conundrum, really, because we'd had nothing all week that suggested that Gomez wouldn't start, and I think that's wise, because I think if that had come out earlier in the week that it was a doubt, and I don't know when his injury occurred, but I think that would have given Watford the upper hand, and they would have looked at utilising Deeney and Deeney's power. Matic was on the bench, and he came off the bench on Monday, so for me he's got more recent minutes in his legs, so surprised that he didn't start above Lovren. And I think Lovren, when he gets a run of games in the team, he can be solid and he can rise to his game. And I think the influence that Van Dijk has is massive. But unfortunately, one of the things that my friend and I were saying after is that he's always got that in him. He's got that clumsy performance in him. Dean has come out after, and I think this is quite damning when a player does this and says that, yeah, we deliberately targeted Lovren. I've heard reports that as soon as the team news broke that there were Watford fans actually fist pumping in excitement that Lovren was playing, because I think they all knew and they all saw that they would utilise those tactics of Deeney. When I've watched some of the replays of Lovren challenging, he does this. He's not going for the ball. He's grabbing, he's holding. He's looking to do anything other than win the ball, which is really frustrating as a fan, because that's what Gomez would be doing. Gomez plays on the front foot. Gomez attacks the ball. Lovren sits and waits and tries to block, and that's not going to work against someone of Troy Deeney's power. Having said that, I think Virgil van Dijk was sloppy as well. He was asleep for the first goal, asleep for the second goal. Midfield wasn't really up to much, and the front three, well, never have I seen a game where all three of them are just not firing. And, you know, it could be a little bit of a wake-up call for fans and players alike, because you're right, I certainly expected that I was going to go out Saturday tea time, I was going to watch the game with my friend, we were going to have a nice time, and Liverpool were going to pick up 3 points. And I think that's made me open my eyes, sit up and think, right, you need to not be so complacent, you need to not be so spoiled, you haven't won it yet, there's still a job to do.
For me, I think Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson are the key. I don't know, I think they're key in how Liverpool like line up, and I think without getting the ball out wide to them, they're nothing. And they just showed that without the balls into the box, the front three aren't really good at creating their own chances. So
you might have an argument there. I think on the day they can. I think what we've seen previously of that, if one has an off day, either two are normally okay. I think all three had an off day, and you mentioned the stat, we had one shot on target, which is absolutely shocking. We had 23 shots on Monday, and to go from that to that, maybe it was coming. And I've read a lot since about the pressure that might have been on the players, whether it was, they'll admit that it was consciously or not, this idea of this relentless winning machine. The law of averages was going to suggest that they were going to lose at some point. It's unlikely that you win every single game. The run that they've been on has been unprecedented. And I think now it's over. I said this to my friend again. We can look back and we can enjoy what we had, and we can look at that achievement as an achievement. And now there are still points to be won, there are still games to be played, and we've got to look to making sure that we fight back, really. We've got Chelsea in the FA Cup on Tuesday. I'll admit I was looking at that as being one I don't mind if we go out, purely selfishly because I've got a ticket for the game against Palace where we would have won the league at home, and I want to go to that. I've got to take that head off now and just look at the bigger picture, which is we're still in the FA Cup, we need to attack that Tuesday night. We've got a Champions League second leg to come, we're 1-0 down. Yes, we are still at the moment 22 points clear at the top of the Premier League, and it looks like that will be sewn up, but it's not done until it's done. We've got to get it done, and that starts at home to Bournemouth on Saturday, so I'm looking forward to that one. We move forward into Sunday then, and then two rivals who took a lot of joy in Liverpool losing, Everton and Manchester United. Decent game, I thought. Really bizarre first goal. What on earth was De Gea doing?
I don't know, it baffles me, because you look at the quality now that we've got Fernandes. Why aren't we like looking to pass to Fernandes? Why are we slowly passing it like at the back? And like we're trying to steal our City play. They love playing out of the back. And Maguire, yes, he's good with his feet, but his passing isn't the best. And Lindelof is just a mistake waiting to happen. I mean, defensively, Lindelof's good. It's just on the ball, he gets quite scared, and he looks like, where's the closest pass to get rid of it?
Yeah.
And then giving it to De Gea, I can see what he's done. He's tried to slow the game down, but he's been put under pressure. And instead of just getting it out for a throw-in, he's smacked it right at Calvert-Lewin, and it's just deflected into the back of the net.
It took an absolute berating at half-time from Roy Keane, if you watched it on Sky. I mean, some of the comments he made were absolutely hilarious. And one of the points he kept making was, what's he waiting for? What was he waiting for? Why do you need to slow the game down a couple of minutes in?
I think that both keepers were a bit shaky.
Mm-hmm.
I think Pickford could have saved the second goal. It went underneath him, but I think about it, it took way too long to hear to clear his lines. He was looking up, he took a touch, he looked up, and then he put it into the path of De Gea. Yeah. If he went down the right hand side, there would have been a little bit more chance of it going through. But he went down the left where Calvert-Lewin was coming in. So
and that just goes to show that there's always that chance if you're lurking, if you're in the right place at the right time, they go in. And I've seen them go in occasionally. Not as much where the keeper's to blame as much as De Gea, and he took a lot of stick, I think, from that. You mentioned Pickford as well, because Manchester United's equaliser, he came in for a bit of criticism about the fact that he looked like he should have covered that at his near post. There wasn't much room to go in. It kind of went under around him. What do you think?
I think that's not as bad as De Gea's mistake. I feel like the movement on the ball from Fernandez's shot was quite... I don't know, it swerved to the right towards Pickford, and then the wind must have caught it and it went back down to the near post and it's gone underneath him. Probably caught him a bit off guard, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then the incident at the end then, so it was a decent game, chances both ends, 1-1. It looked like Everton had won it late on, and then we had a look at a replay. De Gea, was he incited or not?
I think he was... Oh no, it's just very... For me, his eyes looking at the ball, he can see where the ball's going, hadn't made an attempt to move.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was already beaten. So you can see on VAR why they've kind of made a decision off, like, oh, the ball's in the way, so he might try and clumber down to his left-hand side, but it's a definite goal for me.
You think so?
I feel like it was a definite goal, and that's coming from a United fans' perspective, but it's a massive let-off. I mean... Yeah. Sigurdsson was in an offside position, and initially Harry Maguire was calling out that it touched Sigurdsson last,
which
if that touched him, then there would have been no complaints.
Yeah.
It's offside.
But he moved his feet out of the way.
And I feel like De Gea could have done better. He could have gone down to his left, but
he didn't. It was a deflection more. I think if it hadn't took a deflection, we'd be having a different conversation today. I think the fact that it did, and he was already going that way, but he was already made his move to go that way, whether Sigurdsson's there or not, he'd made that decision. And I had a whale of a time with Roy Keane yesterday, because one of the things he said was, why is he not up quicker? Why is he sitting on the floor? It's the last minute of the game, your team's looking to win, get up, move out the way, because if he had done that, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. Everton would have 3 points and them 2-1 winners.
I feel that, I've been saying this quite a bit to my dad and that Maguire, I mean, he's a good defender and all, but when he thinks something's happened, he doesn't react, he doesn't try to stop the ball going in the back of the net. The first thing he looks to do is look at the linesman or look at the ref. He doesn't react, and if he did that last season, 9 times out of 10, the goal would have stood.
You're right.
And he's relying on VAR so much this season. I've seen it so many times, like in the Watford game, the handball, which, fair enough, it hit his arm, but last season, it would have counted as a goal. The first thing Maguire did, instead of blocking the ball off the line, the first thing he did, he let the ball go past him and then complain.
So is that frustrating then as a fan?
Yeah, because we've signed him for all that money, and you're a defender. At the end of the day, you're defending the goal. You're trying to stop shots from happening, and the first thing you're looking to do is complain. And if it comes back on VAR that it's a goal, you just look stupid because you haven't done your job correct.
Absolutely.
And you've just... the first thing you thought of doing is complaining.
Yeah. Another team going for top four then. We had Tottenham at home yesterday. They went 1-0 up to Wolves. I think it then went 2-1 to Wolves, 2-2. Wolves ran out 3-2 winners in the end.
Yeah, I think it was a very end-to-end game, and it was a good game for all neutrals. Wolves and Tottenham are both going for Champions League places. Two informed sides. So it was a good game, and Wolves deservedly won.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like... from my perspective as a United fan, that we kind of wanted Wolves to win because we've played them twice already, and we're coming up against Tottenham in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was a bit surprised because obviously Tottenham went 1-0 up, and then it was 1-1, and then Tottenham went 2-1 up. I was thinking, alright, it's either going to end as a draw or Tottenham are going to win. But you know, Wolves persevered and got the 3 points.
There looked to be some good scenes at the end from the Wolves bench when I saw it on Sky. And we had our first silverware of the season yesterday. So the first domestic final, we had Aston Villa and Manchester City in the League Cup final. The one thing I really hoped was that City wouldn't be 2-0 up after 20 minutes and it would be a repeat of the FA Cup from last year and it would be a bit boring. They went 1-0 up quickly. 2-0 up, we've got this decision where they shouldn't have got a corner. They did get a corner. They score from the resulting corner. Kind of broke West Ham, Aston Villa hearts. Do you think that the pattern of the game changed as a result of that?
I think Aston Villa tried a lot more. I think they were very... Aston Villa, they came out knowing that it's like David and Goliath in that situation. And I think they came out knowing, as long as we put in a good performance, we'll be all right. And especially in the second half, I reckon they dominated.
They did.
And they should have won it, I reckon.
Hit the bar late on, so would have made it 2-2. I wanted extra time. I thought, I fancy watching half an hour more of this.
Yeah, I thought they were down and out, but they got their first goal, made it 2-1, and I thought, oh, could be a game here, but shamefully it ended, you know, 2-1 to City.
Yeah, 3 years in a row they've won that now, so they really like that tournament. Okay. Okay, so for the final part of the podcast this week, we are delighted to introduce our second ever guest. So thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Gallagher.
You're welcome.
And
pleasure
Dan,
to be here.
Would you kick us off with the first question, please?
Yeah, tell us a bit about yourself. What team do you support?
I'm a Celtic fan, so I've supported Celtic all my life, and they're my team.
Yeah, what is your like background with football? So, like, yeah.
So I just always really followed football. My dad was into football. So it's, my earliest memories are always of football. I can remember Scotland were decent back then, so we used to qualify for all the World Cups. 1974 World Cup in West Germany. Shows you how long ago it was. It was called West Germany then. I can remember Scotland qualifying for that, and I can still picture the replica strip because it was one of the first ever times that sort of mass-produced replica strips. They just started to get sold in shops back in the 70s and stuff. So.
Did you have one?
I had a Scotland 1974 World Cup strip, and it got stolen. It got put on, my mum washed it, and it got put on the washing line in our back, we used to call it a back green in Scotland, so our back green, because of the grass, they called it back green. And it got stolen, it got nicked off the washing line.
I always thought that was a myth, so people have often said to me, don't hang your shirts up on the line, because they'll get nicked.
To me. I was only 5 at the time, but they stole my 1974 Scotland.
Oh, proof it happens.
And then the other thing that I remember about that World Cup, it wasn't that World Cup, so it was the 1978 World Cup, which was in Argentina. It was the first time I can remember people buying football strips that wasn't their country. So I had an Argentina strip because it was in Argentina. And I think, if I remember it, I think Argentina won it that year. That was the famous Archie Gemmell goal, I don't know if you've ever heard of
it. Well, these two went.
Against Holland, who got to the final. Scotland beat Holland in the World Cup that year, and Holland were a really good side. They had like Johan Cruyff and all that playing for them. They were brilliant, and we beat them, and then they went on and lost in the final to Argentina. So I got an Argentina top for my Christmas that year, and it was a really big thing. It was the first time really that people started buying tops that weren't for their own teams.
So you mentioned in your introduction that you're a Celtic fan. So can you just elaborate on why that is and your affiliation with the club?
So you don't choose to be a Celtic fan. You're kind of born into it, really. So despite my accent, my family originate from Ireland. So Scotland, back in the sort of 1880s, I think it was, a lot of during the potato famines, I think, or kind of just maybe just after that, a lot of people in Ireland were really poor, and they left Ireland to go and seek sort of not even fame and fortune, but just work and food, because they were basically starving, the Irish people. So some people went to places like Canada and America and New Zealand and Australia and places like that. But if you're really, really poor, you went to the nearest place. The nearest place to Ireland was Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Some people came to England, but they obviously had a little bit more money because they could get further, but the closest place was Scotland, the west coast of Scotland. So I'm from a place called Greenock, which is one of the first ports that you reach when you land in Scotland. And some of the boats made it down into Glasgow and a lot. So what happened is a lot of the Irish people, they formed their own sort of communities, but they were starving, the kids were dying. So there was an Irish priest called Father Wilfrid, who was a monk, and he decided that he couldn't stand by and watch all these Irish kids dying. And he started Celtic Football Club to raise money to feed the starving children, the starving Irish children. So a club, we always say it's more than a football club, but I'm sure every fan of a football club kind of claims
that.
There's a genuine kind of community to Celtic that still exists today. It raises, the foundation raises millions of pounds every year, and it started with charity at its heart and its core. And all they did was charge people to come and watch this football team, and the money went to feed the kids. They called it penny dinner, so it cost 1 pence to feed a starving child.
And people paid it to
people
go?
People paid to go and watch the team, and it just grew from that, Now there's 60,000 people go every week to watch them.
And so that is passed through the generations in your family.
Yeah, and it's
then.
Just, you know, if you're from that background, or you know, you've got that kind of heritage, that bloodline, that's just kind of what you're born into, really. And it's to us more than a football team is.
So can you elaborate on that and just explain the rivalry then that you have with Rangers?
So the rivalry, because most of the people who came over from Ireland were Catholics. I think what happened was is that there was a sort of almost a resistance to, I guess it's a little bit like Brexit in some ways, that there's a kind of resistance to people coming into to other people's
yeah.
territory almost. And I think my understanding, I don't know too much about Rangers, although some of my family are Rangers fans, is that Rangers has a very strong Protestant following now, but that wasn't always the case, is my understanding. It happened back almost as a kind of resistance to Celtic. So this, there was this team in Scotland, Celtic's first ever game was against Rangers.
So they existed already?
They were already in existence, yeah. So it wasn't a hatred at the start, they were quite supportive of each other, and I think it grew from that. But one of my cousins told me that his understanding was is that there was a lot of people came over from Belfast about that time, and actually the Northern Irish and the Southern Irish don't like each other, and there's a real sort of rivalry between those two parts of the country. So it kind of grew out of that. So because the Irish people were supporting Celtic, the people that came over from Northern Ireland, particularly from Belfast, started following Rangers, and that's when the club started becoming a bit more predominantly Protestant. And then you had this kind of religious element to it as well. Although I think that's a lot. What's the word? It's certainly not as severe or as serious as it used to be when I was growing up.
Have you ever been to an old firm derby, and what is it like?
It was that a Friday in Slim Chains. I have lost some weight, you know. I have been to Old Firm Derby. It's quite an experience. I've been to lots of football games. I've seen Man United Liverpool playing before. I've been to one of those games. I don't know if I've told you that, miss, but yeah, I've seen a couple of Man United Liverpool games. But there's something very different about an Old Firm game. The atmosphere is just unrivaled. It's crazy. It's really hard to describe unless you've been. But it just, the noise level just doesn't abate the whole 90 minutes. It's just raucous the whole place is shaking for 90 minutes.
Has it changed a lot over the years?
I think since we moved to all-seater stadiums, I think the atmosphere at all grounds, you guys won't remember in the days when you had terraces, but the atmosphere, I think, in nearly every football ground is probably a bit different than it used to be. You used to be able to just massive big groups of mates, used to be able to stand together and sing and shout, and that's kind of,
yeah, and you can't do that.
You
know,
you were talking the other day about going to watch Liverpool and not being sat with your mates, because you can only get a ticket in a certain seat, and lose a little bit of that, I think, with seats. But Celtic's one of the few, in fact, it might be the only British club that's still got a designated standing area now. About 5, 6, 7 years ago, they got permission to put, I forget what you call it, but
safe
it's
standing.
Safe stand, and it's actually the fancy seats that flip up and lock up.
Yeah.
So they copied that from Europe, but we've got about. There's a section, I think there's about 5,000 people can stand now inside Park End. And I know some of the English clubs are looking at that as well, trying to get, because I think it generates a bit more of an atmosphere. It's in a part of the ground that is affectionately known by the Celtic fans as the jungle, because it's wild.
Says it all.
Yeah, what's your favourite moment with football, and like your favourite game you've been to?
Oh, that's just so hard.
Sprung you on
pick.
That one.
This is probably quite an unusual answer. My favourite game that I've been to, I didn't actually go to the game. So when Celtic got to the UEFA Cup final under Martin O'Neill, we played Jose Mourinho's Porto in the final of the UEFA Cup. It was before they changed all the competitions. Mm. Back then you had the Cup Winners' Cup, you had the UEFA Cup, and you had the Champions League. And they reckon that there was about 100,000 Celtic fans went to Seville. It was in Seville in Spain, the final. But you could, the stadium wasn't very big, and you just couldn't get tickets. So hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, 100,000 maybe, Celtic fans all descended on Spain. I was one of them. But we didn't have tickets for the game, so we watched the game in a park on a giant TV screen. But again, the atmosphere was just phenomenal. And it was one of them games that was kind of, they went one up, then equalised, then they went two up and we equalised, and Henrik Larsson scored both goals, and you're just like, you're with your mates, and my brother was there, and we're like, this is just fate, Henrik Larsson's going to score a hat-trick and we're going to win 3-2, and it went to extra time, and then a blooming goalkeeper made a mistake right at the end.
Aww.
And they scored, so, and it was just heartbreaking. But despite it being a really disappointing result, just the whole experience was phenomenal. We kind of So I drove to Scotland, we got a plane to Portugal, we got a bus to Spain. It was like the film Trains, Planes and Automobiles just to get there. And just the whole few days was just magical.
But the memories it generates is what football's about, isn't it?
We still talk about
it.
And actually, to this day, I still haven't watched the game properly. Because we couldn't see loads of the first half because the Spanish hadn't thought about the sun.
Oh, so
because you don't get the sun very often in Spain, do you? But they hadn't sort of thought about the sun, so we couldn't see the screens in the park until the sun went down. So the first half, I don't really remember too much about the first half because we couldn't really see it. But it was mad. There was just singing, and it was absolutely brilliant. It was just phenomenal.
If we bring it up to speed with the modern day, then if we look at Scottish football compared to English football, what are your thoughts on that?
My dad's probably listening. Look, the standard's not as good for sure. Traditionally, we've been a country, I think, that's punched above our weight. If you think there are more people live in London than live in the whole of Scotland, for a country the size of ours to have three clubs that have won European trophies, Celtic were first ever champions, although it was called the European Cup back then, but the first ever, not just British team, but the first ever Northern European team, because it was all the Latin European teams.
Cool,
it was people, the Italians and Spanish. And, so from Northern Europe, we were the first ever club to win it. And one of the things that's really special about that team that people don't realise, and it will never happen again, but every single player that played that day was born within 30 miles of the stadium, within 30 miles of the park.
That'll never happen again.
So 11 Scotsmen playing for a Scottish team that were all born in 30 miles. It was just one of them that was born 30 miles away. The rest of them, it's like 10 or something like that. It's just mad. It will never be repeated, I don't think. They were very special times, and a thing that people don't remember either is that wasn't the only time Celtic got to the European Cup final. They made it again. They lost the Feyenoord in 1971 as well, or 1970 maybe. So it wasn't a fluke. They were regularly at the top table in Europe back then. But now, I just think I think football's moved on so much now. The science, the facilities. Scotland, the weather's terrible, the pitches are terrible. I think I've told you before that when I played, we played on ash pitches. They weren't even grass. I've got marks on my knees from when I played. I was a centre half, so I used to do sliding tackles on these ash pitches, and they would go into your knees when you cut your knee. And then they progressed in the 80s into gravel. So if you imagine what gravel was like, that was like the latest technology to play football in Scotland. And it was because of the weather, so they needed surfaces that they could still use in the winter. And I think all these things kind of compounded together with maybe kids not playing as much football now, they're on Xboxes and all those things, because we're such a small country that we just don't produce the footballers the way that we used to. And you're a Liverpool fan, and those great Liverpool sides, when I was growing up, they were built, the whole spine of the team was Scottish.
Yeah.
Kenny Dalglish, Graham Souness and Alan Hansen.
Yeah.
And even moving on from then, people like Stevie Nicol and all those, and it was the same at Man United. The spine of those teams were all Scotsmen. Martin Buchan played centre-half for Man United, and they played people like Lou Macari, and even before that, the Cup winning side in 68, and people like Paddy Creeran, who was an ex-Celtic man. A lot of the top Scottish players came to England and were really successful. Dennis Law played on that side as well, who was Scottish. And that doesn't happen so much now, I think, with the influx of players from overseas, that probably those top Scottish guys don't get the opportunity to do that anymore.
And do you think, so you touched on the facilities and the money, do you think that gap's just going to get wider then?
I think you can see it even in the last 10 years, I think that gap's got huge. And what that then does is the gap within Scotland gets bigger as well.
Yeah.
So Celtic, I read a statistic once, it's Celtic and the other mob, between them every week, their attendance is higher than the whole of Scottish football added together. So just to give you an idea of the scale of it.
Absolutely.
Do you think Rangers and Celtic should be allowed in the English football tier, and where do you think they should be placed?
I need to correct you on 2 points there. It's Celtic and Rangers. You're an English teacher, alphabetically that works, doesn't
okay,
it?
Okay.
And there's other reasons why it's that way around as well. But alphabetically, it's Celtic and then Rangers. And it would be lovely to see Celtic play in England, not so much Rangers. No, I think it's a really interesting idea. I'm not sure it will happen in my lifetime. And I think there are reasons for that. If you are Watford, why would you want Celtic and Rangers playing in the Premier League? you know, Rangers get 50,000 fans every week, we get 60,000 fans every week, with access to the TV money plus that kind of match day revenue that you can generate. Even if you're Newcastle, why would you want us there? Because the bigger clubs, in terms of the number of fans that come and watch them, and if they then had access to the TV money, they'd be able to sign top players, because top players would want to come and play because they have the money to do it. And they would, I think, in a very short time, they would both be really successful in England. But it might take 5 or 6 years before they could build a strong enough team to be challenging. But there's no reason why they couldn't. They could be big. Why couldn't they be bigger than Arsenal? You know how many fans that Arsenal get, or Tottenham,
well,
or any,
seats,
Chelsea, or any of those clubs. Man City, in terms of the fan base.
They didn't sell out their Wembley allocation on Sunday, did they?
Yeah.
But would that then, from what you said there, would that mean they would go straight into the Premier League then? Or do you, because we talked yesterday about maybe they should start at the bottom.
But again, I think the same argument applies. So if you are Grimsby Town, they're in the bottom league, aren't they?
Yeah, League Two.
So why would you vote for Celtic to join your league? Because actually, it might mean you don't have a place anymore.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think you're almost kind of, it's like turkeys voting for Christmas, isn't it? And I think, I just don't think it will happen for those reasons. But what I think would be really interesting, because I think both League Cups in England and Scotland are maybe not as exciting as they could be, why don't we have a British Cup instead?
Nice idea.
And it wouldn't just be Celtic and Rangers, but you could open that up to all the Scottish teams. You could open up to the Irish team as well if you want to. Because the Carabao Cup, the final itself is quite serious and gets treated as such, and it's usually full strength teams, but in the run up to it, it's quite often kids in reserves that play for most of these big clubs. And maybe actually Man City drew Celtic in the first round, would they field their kids? Maybe they would, or maybe they wouldn't, and maybe it would just give a bit more excitement to two tournaments that are maybe not quite as good as they used to be.
Maybe
I think that's more likely to happen than Celtic joining the league, because I just don't think, if you're one of the clubs that don't, if you're Man United or Liverpool, you might want it to happen. Because actually, then commercially, you might be able to sell that product a bit better. You know, you could negotiate better TV deals and all those kind of things. You're bringing so many worldwide fans with you that want to watch those games. But I think if you're one of the other teams, I'm not sure why you'd want it.
Yeah.
And logistically, there's trouble with it as well, I think, isn't there, in terms of travel and all those things.
Yeah, Grimsby getting up to Scotland.
Yeah.
Yeah. You touched up briefly about playing when you were younger, like where did you play and like what teams did you play for? Like,
we used to play in the street, so that's how we learned to play football. So outside our house, we used to play. My parents used to hate it because the ball used to hit the windows
all the time.
But we used to play in the street. There weren't as many cars around then, and it's really funny because we used to play, we called it crossy in. So one person's job was to cross the ball, and everyone, there was a defending team and an attacking team. And I got good at heading the ball, but only in one direction, because they used to always cross the ball up the hill, not down the hill. Because if you missed it, it ended up, because Scotland's really hilly, so if you missed the ball, it used to end up way down, and the next straight down.
And no one
so,
wants to go.
So nobody wanted to chase it. So I got really good at heading the ball, but only one way, because when you're on the attack, you had to head it that way.
Strong muscles one side.
When I eventually started playing more organised football when I was a bit older, I was really rubbish at heading the ball the other way. I had to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
So, and it just kind of grew out of there. There was a local team, kids that I kind of played with in the street. It wasn't kids I went to school with necessarily. We were Catholic. There weren't many Catholics where we lived. So we went to the Catholic school, we friends over the kids in the street, and that's what you did back then. You just played with the went to our school and you just played with the kids that were local, and we all kind of went to the local club together.
Yeah, did you have like a league? Because like nowadays we've got leagues where kids can play against each other. Did you ever have like a local football league?
Yeah, we had local football leagues. We also had school leagues as well, so we played for school. And I wasn't a great player. I was a kind of traditional old school sort of centre half. But it's not like now where you're playing out from the back. You get sent off if you tackle someone. Now you used to get about 5 or 6 warnings before they even booked you.
No
so it was. I was just a kind of. I started as a winger because I was quite small when I was a kid and I was quite fast. And as I grew, I kind of moved.
We're
back.
Looking a bit confused about that, aren't
we? So I was a really small kid, and it wasn't until I became about 14, 15, and just sort of really got tall and big and strong. And so I started as a winger, and I moved back to fullback, and then I moved into midfield for a little while, and then I ended up as a centre half. So I was quite a decent passer of the ball because I didn't learn to be a centre half straight from the off. But I just got too big to be playing on the wing.
Not nimble enough, maybe.
Yeah, as you can see, I'm not built like a winger. So. But yeah, we played for school as well, and it was quite. There was cup competitions, but there was also league competitions. I think these days it tends to be a bit more sort of cup based as well as schools. Exactly. But we had leagues as schools.
Do you have a league?
Yeah, we've got a schools cup, but outside of school we've got three leagues in the local area and cup competitions and that.
Just play against the teams. There's barely a week goes by on this podcast where we do not talk about VAR, and we're aware that you don't have it in the Scottish League at the moment. What are your thoughts on it? Would you like to see it in Scotland, or how do you think it's affecting the game?
I don't like it. I think it for me, football's a game of passion, and I think you lose something in that. I was watching a game the other night, and the commentator commented, and he said they think they've equalised.
What have we done to
the game if we don't know for certain at any moment in time whether something's actually happened or not? So they think they've equalised. But we've got to check.
Just got to wait. Yeah, we've talked about that loads.
Everyone's got to wait. The players have got to wait. More importantly, the fans have got to wait. Some people saying, "Oh, it's quite good because you celebrate twice if you then get awarded." But the moment's kind of gone for me. It's that you can't recreate that passion, that instantaneous moment of joy you get when your team score or equalise or get a winner. I think there's enough of the soul of football's been lost already without. I think there's a little bit more of it being pinched. The kind of heart of it's gone a little bit, I think. And it's becoming too clinical almost.
It is, and we've talked about that about every single decision. It's like a forensic process, isn't it? It's not natural.
Part of the joy of football is then having the debate or the discussion the next day about, well, was it onside or offside?
Yeah.
That's part of what podcasts are about and all those things.
And
that's
lose
disappearing, that a little bit.
Isn't it?
And I think that's a shame as well. And you used to always say football's a game of opinions. Well, that's becoming less and less. It's becoming a bit more factual based, which is.
Yeah.
It's good you get the right decision, but they're not getting the right decisions a lot of the time, in my opinion. Mm. I think what would be helpful if they let the ref who made the decision review the footage.
Yeah, but they're
not doing that. It's your decision, so you. You want to check whether you got it right or not. Someone else made the decision, and then kind of.
And it's only another human being. We talked about this last week. It's a person. Yeah. It's another referee. It's not a system.
No.
And that's where we're calling it VAR, like it's an object. It's not a person.
Yeah.
And I think that's.
And is it a person that's interpreting the same rule book as the person that interpreted the rule book in the first place? The only difference is they've got the hindsight and been able to look at it multiple times and from different angles and all those things. But there's still judgment in any decision that you take.
Right, thank you ever so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, boys.